From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's another split for the Democratic primaries. Yesterday, Barack Obama took Oregon and Hillary Clinton won big in Kentucky. Here she is during her victory speech in Kentucky.
It's not just Kentucky bluegrass that's music to my ears. It's the sound of your overwhelming vote of confidence, even in the face of some pretty tough odds. Some have said your votes didn't matter, that this campaign was over, that allowing everyone to vote and every vote to count would somehow be a mistake. But that didn't stop you. You've never given up on me because you know I'll never give up on you.
So, who's got the numbers to win? NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is here to tell us more. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So, debrief us on what happened yesterday and answer the big question. Is this race essentially over despite what Senator Clinton just said?
It's essentially over if you're talking about delegates and the rules and the way the convention chooses its nominee. If you are trying to construct an alternative reality in which it's possible that some of those rules will be changed and some delegates will be changed, that would still admit the possibility that Hillary Clinton can convince enough people to take her side to overturn some of the results that we've seen so far in the process. That's not a really great prospect. The only way that that could happen would be if the superdelegates yet to decide were to come in very heavily, 70-80%, on the side of Hillary Clinton and her version. Now, we don't see any evidence of that happening. In fact, what's been happening is that the superdelegates have been lining up behind Barack Obama 2-1, 3-1, 4-1 over the last several weeks. If that process continues, very shortly he will be over the number needed to secure the nomination. He's quite close to doing it now, and that's in terms of overall delegates. He's already past the point of having an absolute majority among the pledged delegates. He did that last night.
Now, mathematically, you just gave us a sense of what Senator Clinton would need to win the nomination. Let's talk about Michigan and Florida again. Is there a chance that these votes will be added to the tally? I mean, the Clinton spokespeople have been really saying she's won the popular vote. Is that accurate?
She has won the popular vote only if you include some states and you exclude some other states. And it probably won't surprise you to hear that the states you would include would be ones she has won, and states you would exclude would be ones that Obama has won. That's how they can get to that construct of saying that they have won more popular votes. And they are very close in popular votes, no matter how you count it. This has been a remarkably close contest between these two historic candidates. First woman to get this close to the nomination, first African-American. And this has been a very close contest throughout. But in order to get Hillary Clinton out in the lead on popular votes, and she did close the gap further last night because she had a bigger win in Kentucky than Obama had in Oregon, to get her over the top, you have to include Michigan and not give him credit for any votes in Michigan at all. His name was not on the ballot, but the people who wanted to vote for him voted for uncommitted. You'd have to give him no credit for those at all. And then down in Florida, you'd have to count all the votes fully, even though that's probably not what's going to eventually happen. And then in addition to that, you'd have to exclude those caucus states that reported only delegate totals and not the raw vote totals of the actual people who were there voting. Had they been counted, of course, that would add greatly to Obama's numbers.
Do we have any sense of how the Democratic National Committee and Chairman Dean are going to play their cards? I mean, is this going to be a situation where you anticipate they're going to start saying what's going to happen in Florida and Michigan when there's a Rules Committee meeting at the end of the month?
There is indeed, on May 31st, that Saturday, a meeting of the Rules and Bylaws Committee, and they are going to, when would think, decide the issue of what's going to happen with Michigan and Florida. Now, the Michigan situation might be close to resolution because some of the leaders of the Democratic Party there, the same people who insisted on moving their primary into January in cooperation with the Republican Party there, those same people have devised a plan which would give Hillary Clinton about 10 more delegates, 69 to Barack Obama's 59. So she would pick up a net of 10 delegates out of that Michigan compromise. That's not enough to make much difference, so the Clinton people are holding out for a better deal than that, and the Obama people are holding off to see what exactly it takes to get a compromise. But that's what's been proposed by the Michigan Democratic Party itself, and I think that that compromise would be acceptable to the National Committee. Florida is a little tougher. Florida's a lot more delegates yet. We're talking about 185 delegates out of Florida. That's a huge cache. And at this point, you know, that's really the big kahuna. So any compromise out of Florida is going to have to be very carefully vetted by the committee. And one that I've looked at would give her 55% of the vote, give Obama 45% of the vote, and that would pick up almost 20 delegates for her. So between that and the Michigan compromise, she would pick up a net of 30 delegates, and those two states could have their delegations fully seated with full voting rights, as though they had never violated the rules, and they would all be welcomed back into the party, and then I presume there would be some sort of ritual singing of Kumbaya.
Yes, punch and pie, as they say on South Park. So Florida, a little bit more on it. Both of the Democrats were, you know, on the ground, and McCain was there yesterday courting the Cuban-American community, among others. So why is Florida so important, not just in terms of these overall rules, but right now as a campaign stop?
Fourth largest state, and among the four largest states, the one that's most likely to swing. California is probably going to be Democratic. New York is probably going to be Democratic. Texas is going to be Republican. There's just not much doubt about that in any November presidential election in our immediate era. So Florida is the largest really contested state, and as we saw in 2000, it can easily be the fulcrum for the entire national election.
I want to ask you a question about race, and when we see these election results play out, do we see any trends in terms of how white voters vote in states that are more heavily African-American versus ones that have very few African-Americans?
It varies. Let's take, for example, last night's results. And really, there is no easy answer to this question. If you look at these two states, Kentucky and Oregon, they are almost equally white in terms of the overall state population and in terms of the amount of the vote or the proportion of the vote in the Democratic primary that's cast by African-Americans. So you would think that this issue of race would play out at least somewhat similarly in these two states. And yet, in Kentucky, Barack Obama gets 30% of the vote, and in Oregon, he gets almost 60% of the vote, almost twice as large a proportion. So white people are voting for Barack Obama with no trouble at all in Oregon, but they're having a great deal of trouble doing it in Kentucky. They're having a great deal of trouble doing it in West Virginia. And in certain portions of Pennsylvania, that is the non-metro portions, not in the Pittsburgh area, not in the Philadelphia area, and also in some portions of Ohio. And if you look at all of these states, which sound like four very disparate states, the operative part of these states that we're really looking at is quite conjunct, really. It begins in central Pennsylvania, goes south into West Virginia, west through Kentucky, and up into southern Ohio. And this is an area of the country long dominated by the coal industry. The coal industry is still very important there. It's largely rural. It's largely blue-collar. And the people who live there have largely traditional associations, very deep roots in their communities, very strong feelings about many social issues. And this is a community that has been historically somewhat resistant to change, political change, social change, cultural change. So in those kinds of situations, you're probably going to see more people more reluctant to vote either really for the first woman president or for the first African-American president. Now, when you have a face-off between a choice between a woman and a black man, in this particular case, the woman has been winning. Now, whether or not she would prevail in these particular places against John McCain in November, or Barack Obama could contest these areas against John McCain, that's not nearly as clear.
Now, when you think about Senator Clinton's recent allegations that she is the victim of sexism, which we're going to talk about more after our break with a couple of our other political experts, how do you get the sense that, I mean, can we measure, can pollsters, for example, measure the impact of racism and sexism or bias and separate them out from other reasons that people might have for voting or not voting for a candidate?
Tough call. Very difficult problem for pollsters, because when you have a human voice on the telephone asking you questions, you give what pollsters call socially acceptable answers. You don't want to say, no, I'd never vote for a woman to be president. And you don't want to say something similar about race. Some few people do. But how many really are willing to express their feelings fully to a stranger, but a human voice on the phone, when they don't really know who they're talking about and when they know that there's some social disapproval for their forms of prejudice? So that's been a tough one for pollsters. They're trying to think of ways that they might be able to get around that reluctance. For example, asking, would you vote for a black person for president? Okay, well, do you think some of your neighbors might have a problem doing that? Questions of that nature. But it's highly subjective. It gets very squishy in a hurry. It's not the kind of easy binary question, yes, no, go this way, go that way, that pollsters prefer to ask.
Just a quick question. What role do you think pollsters are going to play in this final countdown of the Democratic race specifically? Do you think that by saying that voters are leaning this way or that way, that they will shape the race, as some people argue?
The polls thus far have almost been counter-indicators in many situations, where even when the polls say one candidate should win, Obama or Clinton, that sometimes seems to motivate the opposite result. We saw that in New Hampshire. I think we've seen it in some other states as well. The national Gallup poll has revolved around a 45-45 tie for a number of weeks now. For a number of weeks, Obama and Clinton have been stuck at 45. This week, there was a tick up for Obama, but got him over 50% for a while. He may stay there. He may come right back down again. We've seen kind of an up and down wave in terms of the acceptance of Barack Obama. I don't think that the polls are going to be able to help the Democrats very well settle this. They're going to have to simply stick by their rules or not stick by their rules. They're either going to have to decide they're going to count the way the system was set up to count, or come up with some other alternative system to resolve this issue.
All right, Ron, thanks again.
Always a pleasure, Farai.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor. He spoke to us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And coming up, we've got more analysis from last night's Democratic primaries. Plus, on our bloggers' roundtable, a look at something called love contracts, whether management has a right to interfere with your romantic life. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. For more talk about last night's primaries, record fundraising by Team Obama, and other political news, we've got Donna Brazile, a Democratic strategist and author of a nationally syndicated column, plus Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network, CN8. Hey, folks.
Hi there.
So let's talk, Robert, about last night. You know, a huge victory for Hillary Clinton in Kentucky, less of a win for Obama in Oregon. One thing I brought up with Ron Elving is of NPR is whether or not we can see any trends in terms of how white voters vote based on the population, how many African Americans there are in states. Do you think that that makes a difference in how things play out among white voters?
Well, it sure does. I mean, it depends. I mean, obviously, states like Kentucky and Oregon have lower African American populations. However, states like Pennsylvania, as well as Ohio and some other states that Senator Clinton has won, have significantly large African-American populations. So to make the argument that Senator Obama has a structural problem right now with some blue-collar white Americans, that is factually correct in certain states, to be very clear. In states like Pennsylvania, in states like Ohio, in states where proportionally either A, white middle-class Americans that are Democrat voted for Senator Clinton, and or B, in the exit polling, they had said, assuming that they were telling the truth, that they in fact either A, have an issue with Senator Obama's race, and or B, feel that Senator Clinton is a much more better and or stronger candidate. Now, you can go down the road as to what that means. But yes, I mean, in some states, there is an issue that Senator Obama has to fix between now and November.
Donna, how do you think that race and gender and class are playing out in a matrix? I know that's a huge question, but do you see any trends that you can point to?
Yes and no. First of all, Senator Obama has done very well with white voters across the broad spectrum. he's had trouble in certain regions of the country where perhaps for socioeconomic reasons, voters tend to go with the familiar, meaning the Senator Clinton. But I think overall, Senator Obama has done quite well with the white vote. When you consider that John Kerry, Al Gore, and even Bill Clinton had trouble attracting white male voters. Still, in Bill Clinton's case, he was able to win the presidency twice. Al Gore, he won the popular vote in 2000, and 2004 was a very close election. I would argue that Obama doesn't have a quote-unquote white problem. Obama has a regional problem in winning certain states in Appalachia that may not be as attractive to his message of change in a new direction than they are, say, in other parts of the country. Senator Obama would not be leading right now in both the pledged delegates and superdelegates had he not been able to capture a large segment of the white vote. And according to the Los Angeles Times on May 8th, in terms of the national poll, Senator Obama is behind Senator John McCain only 4 points. Senator McCain has 45% of the white vote. Senator Obama, 41. So, and 41, if you can get 41% of the white vote as a Democrat, since the Democratic Party has not won the white vote since 1964, you can win the election.
Robert, how do you read the tea leaves on the whole seating issue of Michigan and Florida in the Democratic system?
Well, it's a mess. I mean, there's no question about it that it's a mess. I mean, obviously, a lot of people out there will try to put some lipstick on a pig. But the fact of the matter is that millions of people in Michigan and Florida, despite what their state legislator did, despite what, you know, the delegates or whatever the case that the DNC did, these folks came out and voted. And by default, they have now been disenfranchised. Now, the question becomes is whether or not the Democratic National Committee, the Rules Committee, the Credentials Committee and so forth will be able to sit down sometime next week and say, OK, we know that you broke the rules. You explicitly were told not on more than one occasion that if, in fact, you move up your primary, you will not be seated at the convention. Now that the tea leaves, if you will, Farai, are coming home to roost, hopefully there will be some type of a compromise where at least maybe half of the delegates will be seated, whatever the case may be. The issue really is and it's a little tricky, is because, to be fair, in Michigan, Senator Obama, Clinton, Dodd, and so forth, were all asked to remove their names from the ballot. They had a choice as to whether or not to stay on the ballot or to remain on the ballot. Senator Obama obviously chose to stay off the ballot. Senators Clinton, Dodd chose to stay on the ballot. In Florida, it's a little bit of a different story because that's clearly where the Republican state legislature decided to play little games with the Democrats and decided to move their delegation or move their primary up. So it's a bit of a shell game that's going on. But the fact of the matter is, despite whatever argument you may hear out there, millions of people out there did vote, and they, in fact, feel that they have been disenfranchised because their votes, quote unquote, are not being counted, which runs counter to the argument that the Democrats obviously ran on and certainly campaigned on from 2000 to the present.
Donna, there's a Rules Committee meeting on May 31st. Do you think, as someone who works with the DNC, do you think that there's going to be a public announcement right after that saying what's going on?
Well, let me just say in full disclosure, I'm a member of the Rules and Bylaws Committee as well, appointed 10 years ago, and that's what makes me a superdelegate as well.
Donna is a superwoman.
No, we know that. Yeah.
I'm just a hardworking person. Let me just say this, that the Republican National Committee also penalized those two states for violating its rules on time. And their penalty was 50% of delegates. Our penalty was 100% of all delegates. We were trying to send the most strongest possible message that we did not want any state to hold their contest in the calendar year of 2007. We will, on May 31st in Washington, D.C., in a public meeting that hopefully will be televised on C-SPAN and other cable outlets, we will reconsider our penalty in light of what Robert said, that the voters should not be penalized. We will give a fair settlement to both states, irregardless of the candidates who might be leading, who might be behind. We will come up with a fair recommendation to the body, and I hope that the 48 states that comply with the rules will accept our resolution, and we can go forward toward the convention unified as one party.
All right, Donna, I'm going to stick with you for a second. We heard Hillary Clinton address sexism yesterday. She called for equal treatment of sexism and racism. She also blamed the press for failing to take on misogynists. And she seemed to reach out to women in her speech last night. So as a black woman, as I am, how do you think sexism plays out and racism? I mean, are the ways that they're expressed apples and oranges, or are they playing out similarly with the two candidates, but in, you know, obviously racism on one hand, sexism on the other?
I think, first of all, there's been both. And this has been a historic campaign season with two unconventional candidates, one woman, one black man. There's no question that sexism as well as racism have reared their ugly heads once again. Subtle forms, but still, of course, they are part of the undercurrents in American politics. But to somehow suggest that sexism or racism alone has defined this moment, when in fact the two finals are people who traditionally don't get to the finals. So I think we need to look at and not just the ugly forms of racism and sexism that I've seen throughout the campaign season, whether we're questioning whether or not Obama is black enough and then he's too black and spent 6 weeks talking about if he's as angry as his minister, or is he, is he out of the mainstream, a patriot, or some of the ugly misogynistic terminology used to characterize Senator Clinton's clothes, her hair, her sound of her voice. There's no question that we've seen both in this race. But I also think that we need to celebrate this moment. This has been a historic election season, record turnout, record participation, record amount of money raised, and that is because we have two equally qualified candidates running for the office, and there's no reason to stir up any additional resentment. Let's talk about racism, let's talk about sexism, but let's also talk about the characters of the candidates and see if we can come up with the best candidate to defeat John McCain in the fall.
Robert, I'm going to turn to money, which is something Donna just mentioned. The Obama supporters are still emptying out their wallets. They, have emptied them out to the point where he has $37 million in the bank compared to a deficit for Senator Clinton, and Senator McCain has $22 million in the bank. He didn't raise the most money this month, but overall he has raised the most money of any candidate. So are we going to see Senator McCain pulling up financially? Because he raised nearly $18 million in April, which was his best month yet. Are we going to start seeing the Republican candidate pulling up in the money game?
There's no question about it that, first of all, let me just back up and say that this year has been, or this presidential cycle has been, an absolutely fascinating money race just to watch. Senator Obama to date has raised $272 million. Senator Clinton has raised $221 million to date. And Senator McCain to date has raised about $100 million. If you take a look, first of all, this will probably be the first billion-dollar election ever. That's number one. But also number two, to answer your question specifically, Farai, there's one person out there, despite his low approval rating and so forth, say whatever you want about him, he is a prolific fundraiser on the campaign trail, and that's George W. Bush. Starting next week on the 27th and the 28th, the president's going to be in Utah raising money for the RNC as well as for Senator McCain. Also on the 28th, former Governor Mitt Romney is going to be rattling the cage for the Mormon community for John McCain and a joint fundraiser. So behind the scenes, President Bush is going to work like the Dickens to make sure that Senator McCain has the resources to be able to defeat Barack Obama in the fall. That's one. Also, two, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, has more cash on hand, about $40 million cash on hand compared to the Democrats, I believe, has about $20 million cash on hand. So look to those two arms to really help not only Senator McCain, but also Senator Obama as well. There's no question about it that both of these candidates will have enough resources to compete in the fall.
All right, Donna.
Can I make a little news? The DNC has announced a combined fundraising operation with Team Obama, Team Clinton. And next month in June, my former boss, Al Gore, will be the featured guest at the first combined fundraising event featuring Hillary and Barack donors. So I'm excited about that. The party's coming together. It's been a long campaign season, but I can see the end in sight.
And Al Gore has not been very present in this campaign. So this is a big step for him to kind of get in the mix.
I've been waiting to see that Nobel Prize, so I'm looking forward to seeing Al Gore out there.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Farai.
We've been talking politics with Donna Brazile, a Democratic strategist and author of a nationally syndicated column, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. They both joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Michelle Obama takes some political heat from the Tennessee Republican Party, and Barack defends his woman. For more, we've got Jeffrey Bennett, the web producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So the Tennessee Republican Party launched a web video campaign last week slamming Michelle Obama for her remark that she was proud of America, quote, for the first time in her adult life. What's been the response online?
Well, some say it's shameful and others say it's par for the course. So here's the background. The Tennessee GOP released a 4-minute video on YouTube contrasting a snippet of Michelle Obama's words with that of several Tennesseans talking about why they're proud of America. And the idea was to paint Michelle Obama as unpatriotic. And to that, Barack Obama had a few words for the opposition. Here's some of what the Obamas had to say on Good Morning America talking to Robin Roberts on Monday.
The GOP, should I be the nominee? I think can say whatever they want to say about me, my track record. If they think that they're going to try to make Michelle an issue in this campaign, they should be careful.
We're trusting that the American voters are ready to talk about the issues and not talking about the things that have nothing to do with making people's lives better.
But I also think these folks should lay off my way.
All right. That says a lot, you know.
Right.
Lay off my wife. It's like, or what? Is he putting up his dukes? How are people responding on the blog?
Well, on our blog News and Views, here's what some people had to say. Claire Garcia wrote, if the spouse is going to be out campaigning, representing policies and views, then of course she can be targeted. You can't have it both ways. Another reader, Matthew Scallon, said the potential scrutiny of his family is the main reason why he never went into politics. Emoji Odorinde, who comments on our blog pretty frequently, says, it's not fair to attack a candidate's spouse or a family member, except for Bill Clinton, who's on another level being a former president.
Do you think that we're going to see more folks talking about this on the blog? Because she's been, you know, Michelle Obama has been one of our most popular blog topics, especially once you put up that whole thing about who should we cast in
right.
the role. I think a lot of people are intrigued.
I think they are. And Regina King is still the number one contender to play Michelle Obama in that movie whenever it hits the theaters.
All right. This week we also had another installment of the Speak Your Mind series. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a piece from Kyle Yadell about Morehouse graduating its first white valedictorian over the weekend. There was a lot of media coverage about that. And Yadell's take was that too much was being made of race, and some seemed to validate the existence of a place like Morehouse with the notion that Joshua Packwood, who was the white valedictorian, went there and did well and excelled and became valedictorian. So this Speak Your Mind essay can be found in our blog, and it's drawing a lot of reaction, responses like these. Ian Labatou wrote, taking nothing away from my Morehouse brothers' earned accolades, the media should have done a better job highlighting the fact that Mr. Packwood's accomplishments are not unique to him. And P. Smith wrote, Kyle's commentary makes a valid point that we often focus on race more than individual greatness.
All right. What other things are going on the blog?
Well, Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, mostly because they could, decided to buy the school for their two kids because they are disappointed with the public education system. So they ended up leasing a nearby high school. So people are talking about that, as well they should. There's a new book about the hidden download culture in hip-hop, and we're talking about the latest in the Sean Bell case.
Yeah, I posted yesterday the officers in the Bell case were acquitted of manslaughter charges, but now they and five other officers, including their supervisor, are up for possible discipline from the New York Police Department. So we're going to keep an eye on that. And also, you know, if you go and read the blog, you'll get details that follow up on another incident involving the police. In general, these law enforcement stories, do they have a lot of traction on our blog?
They do. Everyone has an opinion, and especially when you have video like we did for the Philadelphia police beating. You know, it just makes it all the more ripe for conversation.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from our studios at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. According to emails released by the Secret Service, agents joked about Jesse Jackson being assassinated. Should employees who date coworkers be required to sign a love contract? And should LA police toughen immigration enforcement after the killing of a black high schooler? That's all on our bloggers roundtable. And with us today, freelance journalist Danielle Belton. She runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. Former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, he blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio, and Brandon Whitney runs the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. Welcome, everybody.
How you doing?
Thank Hello. You for
allowing us to be here today.
Always. All so right. Let's start with a topic that we covered on the air yesterday. In March, 17-year-old Jameel Shaw Jr. was gunned down outside his home in South Central L.A. The man accused of killing him is an alleged gang member who's in the U.S. illegally. Now, the family of Jameel is now proposing Jameel's law, which they hope will crack down on illegal immigrant gang members in Los Angeles. It's seemingly increased tense relations between Latinos and African Americans in parts of Los Angeles. Yesterday on the show, we spoke with Jameel's parents, Army Sergeant Anita Shaw, who was serving in Iraq when her son was killed, and Jameel Shaw Sr.
He saw this black kid walking on a quiet street, and he was out there looking for blacks to kill anyway. So he just stumbled up on my son, but at the same time, he stumbled up on public outcry. This has been going on before my son was murdered. This isn't the first time. It's just been disguised, you know, and people are waking up and realizing that there are people out there today that are killing people because of their skin color.
All right, Kevin, Mr. Shaw is not shy about saying he thinks that this was a race crime. What are other folks saying in Los Angeles? Is it a race thing, a gang thing, a random thing?
Yes. All the above.
All the thing.
All the above. What's interesting about this case, having spent a number of years as a prosecutor here in Los Angeles and three of those years in the hardcore gang unit, one of the things that's interesting about gangs and violence and this whole gang culture, which we didn't see so much in the last few years, but with technology being where it is right now, you have this issue of what they're calling net banging, where individuals get online and they may not necessarily be active in the gang from a standpoint of actually doing any killings or murders or drug exchanges back and forth. But there is this glamorizing of the gangster lifestyle. So you have this Jameel Shaw young man who, by all accounts, seemed to be someone who we would herald as the person who could be the valedictorian that would take out the Anglo valedictorian at Morehouse and all of that thing. But what we also have is this issue of him really kind of glamorizing this lifestyle. And so the question becomes now, was he actually flirting with this type of gangster mentality? And it's very compelling when you see those images of him seemingly flashing gang signs. You cannot live in L.A. and not understand the concept of red and blue. And he had it all over him. And so you have to ask the question, is it race or is it gang or is it a combination?
Yeah, Danielle, he was allegedly, and we're talking about the victim here, Jameel Shaw Jr., flashing a gang sign on his MySpace page. That is the image that people have seen. And now there are a couple of activist groups in Los Angeles proposing that MySpace actively look for gang-related words and images and et cetera on MySpace and take down any pages that have that. Danielle, do you think that's going to work? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, it sounds like a good idea in principle, but I don't think it's going to work. Basically because there has been a huge, huge glamorization of gangster culture going back as far as when NWA first hit the national scene as a rap group. And even early NWA talked about the perils of life in Compton and on rough L.A. streets. They didn't necessarily glamorize it as much, but when you each successive rap group since then that has been qualified in the gangster rap category, it's gotten less and less about, oh, we live in a poor neighborhood, oh, horrible things happen here, we're just telling our stories, to, oh, I'm crip walking and it's so cool. I mean, Snoop Dogg, constantly references him being a crip and crip walking in his music on like very, very popular songs like, Drop It Like It's Hot that you'll hear on radio, all the time. So it's not surprising that he would have something like that up on his MySpace page and not actually be a gang member, because you have so many kids who just see that as, oh, it's just interesting, it's just neat. You know, I just want to claim it. I mean, I can remember being
That's what they
kid.
Call them, apparently, claimers, people who are,
yes,
you know, kind of interested in the gang life but not absorbed in it.
Exactly, exactly. And like when I was in elementary school, when the film Colors came out, you know, I didn't see it because my parents didn't allow me to see anything but, you know, Walt Disney films. But it was like as soon as that movie came out, almost every kid in my elementary school was all of a sudden like, oh, I'm a Blood, I'm a Crip. And it just seemed insane that, you know, that they would want to be part of that. That they weren't actual gangbangers. They just thought it was cool because they'd seen the movie Colors.
I'm sorry, I've got that theme song running through my mind right now. It's a very mediocre song, but somehow it's stuck to a little
colors,
part of my
colors.
Brain. Colors.
You know,
colors.
My biggest fear about it, though, is more than the gang element, is the anti-immigration spin, which is possibly there. For about 200, maybe 300 years, poor whites in the South got distracted from issues that really affected them because they were worried about race as opposed, instead of economic issues or health issues. I'm afraid poor and middle-class African-Americans can get so caught up in this anti-immigration fervor that we ignore the issues that affect us at a greater level.
But, Brandon, I have to tell you, with all due respect, it's not just poor and lower economic class African-Americans. The issue of immigration for someone who spent 15 years in the court system, you definitely have this issue with African-Americans saying, we are not getting construction jobs. We're not getting jobs where individuals are being paid under the table. And so when you have this issue of Special Order 40, which is what you were alluding to with respect to changing the laws so you can't get additional information from people who could be illegal in this country, you are really tapping into an issue that transcends party, that transcends gender, that transcends economic class. There are a number of African-Americans, myself included, that really have an issue with our illegal immigration policies.
Brandon, do you think this is going to come up in the election this fall?
I don't think it's going to be as big an issue as it has been in the past, only because I don't think either party knows what to do with it. And they haven't been able to get any type of legislation one way or the other through Congress, and I don't think it's going to happen before this election in November. But again, it's the type of issue that people can get obsessed with, they can become Minutemen and things of that nature, and it does not improve their lives at all. The reason that there aren't jobs, blue-collar jobs, for middle-class African-Americans and middle-class whites is not because of immigration. It's because those jobs have been exported to other countries. And that's because of the way we set up our trade agreements. And what has happened is that the immigration issue has become a red herring of sorts, something to just focus on instead of focus on the real issues. And it's dangerous for African-Americans to fall into that trap because, again, poor whites in the South have been stuck in that trap for about 250 years.
I actually want to move on to – go ahead quickly, Daniel.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say that I agreed with him to a certain extent, but I lived in Bakersfield, California for 5 years. And a lot of the resentment that I found that most African-Americans felt was that most Mexican-Americans were completely ignorant to the struggle that Black Americans made to get the rights that they benefited from in California. So a lot of people felt, you know, hey, you know, I did all this work and they're giving me all this attitude, telling me that I'm lazy, telling me that I need to get myself together, that, you know, that the Black people are bad. And it's like, I suffered for you.
Right.
You
know, well, some people would argue that Cesar Chavez hasn't gotten his due as a civil rights leader, where his work would also affect African Americans.
Yeah, but that's not just illegal immigrants either. I mean, most ethnic groups are unfortunately ignorant about the African American contribution to the United States,
including African Americans.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So it's not,
hello.
It's not unique. It's not unique to illegal immigrants, and not just. I mean, it's so many different issues, and illegal immigration is such a small part of the problem that we need to deal
with.
All right, let me move on to a lawsuit by Black Secret Service agents. It's turning up some controversial emails. Reverend Jesse Jackson ran for president in 1984 and 1988, and like all candidates, major candidates, he got Secret Service protection. Now, this lawsuit dug up an email titled Righteous Reverend, and it jokes about a fictional death of him and his wife when a missile struck their plane. The email ends with, quote, "It certainly wouldn't be a great loss and probably wouldn't be an accident either." So, Kevin, since getting wind of the emails, Reverend Jackson now requested to read every single one concerning him and his family. Should the Secret Service release them?
Absolutely. And the reason that I say that is, you look at this from the broader context of this 2008 presidential election, and you have seemingly amongst many African Americans this fear of Barack Obama's safety. And you have these individuals who have basically sworn their allegiance to potentially take a bullet for the person that they're guarding. I think it undermines where we are from a standpoint of, can we get past race? You know, what's interesting about this whole conversation about Jesse Jackson, who's to say that those same dynamics could have been taking place when Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro were running for office? And so I think that for the government to establish themselves, because right now we're looking somewhat with a jaundiced eye as it relates to this country, through their actions and individuals who work for the government, showing institutional racism.
Now, Brandon, Jackson also wants a congressional investigation. Do you think that's necessary?
It probably would be. I don't have a lot of faith in Congress in terms of investigations, though.
Brandon's a cynic, huh?
Yeah, just a little bit, just a little bit. But, I mean, I think it basically just brought to light some things we've already known. Like, racism still exists. It's institutional. And it's good to bring it to the light. We don't want to see racism where it's not, but we do want to recognize it where it is. And we have to say, okay, this happened. How do we fix it? And take the appropriate action. And so I think, you know, maybe Jesse isn't the best person to take to the forefront, because a lot of people, because of who he is, will not give the type of attention it's due.
But that's exactly why it should be him. I mean, when people talk about Miranda and your Miranda rights, most people don't realize that Miranda was a drunk. And this individual had a long record and was not anyone that was necessarily known as being this upstanding citizen. It's because it is a Jesse Jackson that would make people say, okay, you know what? If all the presidents, we've had 43 white men, you know, Barack Obama isn't the first African-American. People are all on this bandwagon about why are blacks so gaga over Barack. I'm like, hello, Shirley Chisholm, Cynthia McKinney, who's running right now. Nobody's even talking about her. Carol Moseley Braun, you can go on, Al Sharpton, Jesse ran twice. The real issue is, are we transcending race? And when it raises its ugly head, we need to deal with it.
I think yeah,
let me get Danielle in, because I want to move on to another topic after this. Some folks say, and I think this is what Kevin was alluding to, that this is grandstanding by Reverend Jackson because he wants media attention. Do you think that's fair to say that?
Well, I don't think it is, because, I mean, this is a really a serious issue. It makes me think of, in some ways, you know, the Secret Service and the military have some parallels, whereas the military can't work unless everyone's on the same page, everyone's on the same team and working towards the same goal. The Secret Service can't work unless everyone agrees the number one, you know, most important thing is to protect who we're assigned to protect. And that is, you know, that is the above all goal. It's not funny to joke about. This is the reality. This is our job. We're all on the same page.
So, I think it's also interesting
to me that's what it's really about.
Yeah, that if that's how little they valued his life, it says a lot about
exactly
how much the rest of our lives as young African-American men and women are valued as well. So I think it kind of plays into a lot of the stuff that happened with Sean Bell and every other young African-American man whose life is in danger when he gets pulled over.
All right, exactly. Got to go to one final topic, and we don't have a lot of time, but it's a little spicy. You know, some folks find love at work. Some people end up filing sexual harassment lawsuits instead. And some companies are now asking employees to sign a consensual relationship agreement or a love contract. And it basically says, look, if you guys are having a relationship, don't go ahead and file any sexual harassment suits when things are over. Danielle, do you think that that's fair, or is it overstepping the bounds of the company?
No, it totally needs to happen. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've worked in places where you have office relationships. People go, you know, above and beyond. It gets ridiculous. You know, people step over the line. And so I can fully understand why a company would want to do that.
Now, see, Danielle, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with my sister. I just started a company. It's called Three Base Media Group. So now me being an employer, I'm looking at it from a whole different standpoint because those liability issues come into play. And I would submit to you that if it were your company, you may have a little bit more of a sensitivity from a standpoint of, look, I'm paying health and dental and workers' comp, and I have to retain an attorney. If you all are going to be doing all this on my time, I want to make sure I'm protected. And I think that's the perspective that most employers are taking.
I think it's a sign that the laws.
I was actually agreeing with you.
Yeah, I think that Daniela does agree with you.
I think it's a sign that the laws just need to be tweaked a little bit. I mean, it's if you can get sued as a company because somebody came on to somebody else in the wrong way, and you haven't had an opportunity to respond to that yet, it's unfair. And I understand why they want to defend themselves. So the laws probably need to be tweaked a little bit so that they're a lot more reasonable than they probably are at this point.
I've worked at a lot of companies where there are tons of intercompany marriages. And, you know, considering how much of our time we spend at the job, at the J-O-B, I mean, Danielle, it sounds like what you're saying is that there should be legal protection, but there shouldn't be a barrier on dating. What do you think about the idea of just saying banning dating in the office?
No, I can understand dating, because, I mean, often what happens is, and, you know, I've worked in journalism, and my mother's worked in education, and a lot of times the only people you know are other teachers in journalism. The only people you know are the other journalists because you spend so much time at work. So it's understandable that, you know, people would seek all their relationships at work as well. The only problem is that you just have some people who, you know, they just cross the line. We had a young man at my last newspaper who was fired because he basically made some untoward statements about one of our bosses having a relationship with another, an employee below her. So It's just messy. It's just very, very messy.
It's all these women bosses. That's what it is.
Uh-oh. Kevin, why do you always have to blow up our letter segment? Why do you always have to blow it up?
I'm and just the Rush Limbaugh of NPR. I'm sorry. I had to just throw it out there for the sake of...
We don't even have time to respond to that. So
I'm teasing.
So I'm going to have to let you guys go. Thank you so much. And we've been talking with the controversial former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He also hosts the Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio. He was here with me at our NPR West studios. Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors, he was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Danielle Belton, who runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes, she was at member station KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. You can also go and speak your mind in our ongoing series.